to school to prove to Dad that I'm not a fool. I got my lunch packed up, my boots tied tight. I hope I don't get in a fight. Oh, back to school, back to school, back to school.
All right, everybody. We have arrived in August. Now, this is that magical time of year that parents anticipate and children dread. That time when we put away the fun of summer nights and pool parties and we bring out lunch pails and backpacks. Now, for some teenagers out there, this probably signals the inevitable end of a summer camp romance. And for some adults out there, this suggests the incoming freedom of your children being gone for at least 8 hours every single day. So, either way, one thing is for certain. Thanks to federal law, if you are between the ages of 5 and 17, you will be headed back to school. So, welcome to another episode of Health Matters. I'm Dr. Patrick Lavo, and I'll be your host this evening. Joining me in the studio while we're talking about back to school and back to school health, I have two excellent physicians, Dr. John Van Cherry and Dr. Jennifer Singh. Thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Quick overview. Dr. Van Cherry is the Vice Chair for Pediatric Research at LSUS and the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease. Has a litany of places that he has attended school. Good gracious. He's even waving me off. Don't go there, he says. Let me tell you, there's a lot. And Dr. Singh is the Director of Integrative and Lifestyle Medicine Services at Feistweiler Cancer Center, and she is board certified in lifestyle medicine. Now, Dr. Singh, before we even get started, I would like to know, what exactly is lifestyle medicine? Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Lifestyle medicine is the intensive application or use of our lifestyle habits, the things that we do every day, what we put in our mouth, how much we move our body, whether or not we smoke cigarettes. Studies in the past couple of decades have really revealed how incredibly powerful those small daily choices are to improve our health.
Wow.
And this specialization focuses on me helping patients change those things to keep themselves as healthy as possible.
Sort of a holistic approach to medicine.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. I would tell you out there, if you are out there in the community and you're interested in what we're talking about, or if you want to just talk to a few physicians who you have their ear, and I know they can't leave for another 58 minutes, so you've got them. The number to call is 1-800-552-8502. Remember, we have a pediatrician and a lifestyle specialist. I mean, we've got infectious disease, call and pick their brains if you don't like what we're talking about or you like what we're talking about. We love to talk to callers. So let's just start this off. So we're going back to school. What? Now, this covers a broad range of people. So I feel like we're going to hit some people that have elementary schoolers that are about to start. And then we're also going to have people who are like going to go into their senior year. So obviously, we've got a gamut of health needs here. But let's talk about elementary school first. So I want to talk about vaccines, because this is a hot button topic. You know, you've got the anti-vaxxer thing. You've got people who aren't allowed to go into school. I want to say that there was a thing in California where some kid wasn't allowed to come to school because he didn't have vaccinations. And then there's this whole movement of parents that don't vaccinate their kids. So talk to me about that. Like, what is the value of these vaccines? Is there any truth to all this stuff? Talk to me a little bit.
So vaccines are one of the two major advances in medicine in the past 100 years that have really changed life expectancy dramatically. We have saved millions and millions of lives with the vaccines that we have. And so, you know, I always say in the big picture, we have defied evolution in just incredible ways in the past 150 years. And what that means in the outcome is that kids are healthier than they've ever been in human history. Hospitalization rates for children are lower than they've ever been. Death from infectious diseases is at an all-time low, especially for children. And we're doing some even more incredible things by vaccinating children against common bacteria like Streptococcus pneumoniae. We're actually protecting grandma and grandpa. Their rates of death from Streptococcus pneumoniae have gone down since we started vaccinating kids more effectively. So these vaccines are not only good for children, but they're good for our entire society, and they protect all of us from infectious diseases.
Okay. Now, dumb it down for me a little bit, because I mean, we always talk about vaccines and we sort of just make this blanket statement like everybody knows this is a vaccine, it's a good thing. Or, you know, some people, this is a vaccine, it's a bad thing. What is a vaccine? Like, explain it to me a little bit. What are we getting here?
So a vaccine is like a fire drill for your immune system. So think about when you were in first and second grade, and our children who are in first and second, third grade, every school grade, they do fire drills. Mm-hmm. And the fire drill is meant to educate a child in advance of if there's a fire, this is what you should do. And that's exactly what a vaccine does. It educates your immune system to know what to look for and the signs of a particular germ that can be bad and what to do when you see those germs or that particular germ and how to respond to it so that there's not life or limb damage to your body. And so this fire drill for your immune system is exactly what vaccines do. And I also compare them to some of the lifestyle things we talk about, wearing seatbelts, wearing bicycle helmets. The reason we do those is to prevent injury.
Sure.
And the reason we use vaccines is to prevent infectious diseases.
Okay. Because I guess, you know, a lot of these things we get kids vaccinated for nowadays, it almost seems almost an unreal threat. You know, we're like, oh yes, we're vaccinating our children against the measles. Like, no, who has the measles these days? I don't need that vaccine. I mean, is there value in getting these vaccines? Who's getting the measles?
There's tremendous value in it. And actually, so look, just a few years ago in 2014, I believe, there was this outbreak of measles that started at Disney World of all places. And Mickey Mouse got the measles.
It's the happiest place on earth. You can't have measles there.
But you can get measles there, apparently. At that time, you could. So what we know is that the vaccines not only protect the person who's getting the vaccine, but they also help protect people around them who may not be able to be vaccinated.
Sure.
And for a child who is not vaccinated against measles, their likelihood of actually getting measles is somewhere around 30 to 50 times that of a child who's vaccinated.
Wow.
So this is not a trivial rate. And measles is a great example. It is the most infectious pathogen we know, the most infectious germ.
Really?
You can walk in a room where somebody has been with measles 2 hours prior and breathe the air and get measles from it. That's how infectious this germ is.
That's outrageous.
It's incredible.
Wow.
It's not outrageous. It's incredible.
I mean, that's measles is determined.
Measles is absolutely determined. And for kids who have an immune problem that we can't fix or even that we don't know about, measles will find them. And it'll be deadly.
Wow. So now I guess that brings up the big question then. So vaccines are great. They prevent you from getting measles 2 hours after the kid with measles left. But is there any truth to this, you know, the anti-vaxxer movement, the idea that, you know, there's some link to autism or the autism spectrum with vaccinations? Is there any legitimacy to that? I mean, I know there's a lot of arguments made on that front. So talk to me a little bit about that.
So there's a lot of concern. There is no scientific data that links any vaccine to autism. Black and white. Absolutely no data to support an association or causation between any particular vaccine or all vaccines or receiving a subgroup of vaccines and the development of autism.
Can you speak to kind of where that that fear originated from?
Sure. More than 10 years ago, 12 or 15 years ago, there was a publication out of the United Kingdom that reported an association between children who had autism and detection of infectious disease agents like measles in their gastrointestinal tract. And that report really did more damage to our public health than any report probably in an extremely long time, because not only was it bad science, it was found that it was supported by people who were interested in making an association. So when you go looking for an association like that, and you're paid to find an association like that,
you usually
oftentimes
can.
You will.
Interesting how research works like that.
That's not true research.
Yeah,
that's a scam.
So I guess that's something we could talk about. That could be an entire show. Maybe we'll have an entire show on just vaccines. But let's move on a little bit to maybe a more broader generalization. So you've got kids going back to school. Obviously, elementary schoolers get vaccines. Like, is there a schedule for this? I mean, should they be done with their vaccines by the time they go to elementary school?
So the routine vaccine schedule for infants is at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, and a booster at 12 months of age. And then there are some vaccines that they get, like a booster for chickenpox at 4 years of age.
Sure.
So by the time they start first grade, they should be completed all of their vaccines that they need until they're in the 10, 11, 12-year-old age range.
Okay, so what happens if they're not, you know, let's say they're behind. So some mom out there, God bless her, is listening to the show, and she's like, what, I need to get vaccines?
Right.
And now her kid's about to start kindergarten in 2 weeks.
So
what does she do?
Yeah, the vaccines, if they're not up to date on their vaccines, number one, they can start school. The school will report and talk to them about, you know, that they're missing 3 or 4, whatever it is, vaccines they're missing. And then they'll have a sort of a grace period to go get those vaccines.
Okay.
And That's nice and simple.
But it's not necessarily dangerous for that kid because, I mean, he's not protected.
It is a risk. Mm-hmm. But we weigh risk and benefits, and kids who are missing school shouldn't be missing school.
Gotcha.
And in this case, even for things that everybody worries about, like lice, kids should go to school.
We're going to talk about lice later, so I'm glad you brought that up. Now, I guess that, are you completely protected after the first round of vaccines? Because you said there's three rounds, or do you...
So the different vaccines require a different schedule to get optimum protection. For influenza, the flu, mm-hmm. you need a new vaccine booster or vaccine shot every year because mm-hmm. the flu changes every year, right? So
sure.
For that, you definitely need that annually. When it comes to things like measles, the measles that circulates out in the wild and consequently our vaccine haven't changed for more than 40 years. And so the same measles vaccine that we used 40 years ago protects us now
gotcha.
Against measles.
Dr. Singh, I know we're going to get you in here. I feel like I'm picking on Dr. Vancheri right now. I just know that he's the vaccine guy. Infectious disease in pediatrics. I mean, if there was more your wheelhouse, I don't know what it is. This is like a slow pitch right down the middle here. So you said children, you know, prior to elementary school, and then you said again 12, 13. Well, what changes at 12, 13? What are we doing then?
So the use of vaccines is related to risk and mm-hmm. risk assessment, right?
Sure.
So we know toddlers are susceptible to and more likely to die from certain infectious diseases. And as you grow older, your risk of those goes away, but you gain risk for other things. Mm-hmm. And so at the 10, 11, 12-year-old age range, we're vaccinating against meningococcal disease. This is a bacteria that causes meningitis and sepsis and overwhelming infection. This is the one that is a 1 in a million infection and a 1 in a million kind of disease. It's rare,
sure,
but its outcome can be fatal or cause life loss of limb in adolescents in particular. So okay. We vaccinate against that. And there are five different flavors of that germ, if you want to call it that, that we have vaccines against at this point. And then everybody gets a booster of diphtheria and tetanus that includes a pertussis booster. Pertussis mm-hmm. immunity, we know, wanes after a few years. Current vaccines are not quite as effective as the vaccines we used 20 years ago.
Hmm.
But the good news is they're a lot safer. So we opt for safety. We have safer vaccines, but their effectiveness wanes a little bit. So we need boosters at 10, 11, 12.
It's the Subaru of vaccines.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's not nearly as flashy, but boy, it's safe.
Boy, it's safe, exactly.
Boy, it's safe. You show up in a Subaru, you know you got there safe.
So, and then the other big one to talk about at 10, 11, 12 years of age is the human papillomavirus vaccine, HPV vaccine.
HPV vaccine. Now, I know that HPV vaccines have been, I feel like they're standard now. And
they
for
are.
A little while there, they were sort of coming up and they were optional. And do you get it? Do you not? I feel like it's pretty standard now. But is it for boys? Is it for girls? Because, I mean, you think about cervical cancer with HPV.
Right.
But.
So it is recommended for both boys and girls. And at the 10, 11, 12-year-old age time period, we call that the pre-adolescent visit. And the HPV vaccine is one of the most effective vaccines we've ever made.
Hmm.
It is amazing in how potent it is at preventing papillomavirus-associated disease, not just cervical dysplasia, ultimately cervical cancer,
wow.
but other cancers that men can get, and we could go into all the details of those.
Sure.
But the one area that's fascinating is the area of head and neck cancers. And so you're well aware of this.
I am. I was hoping you'd bring it up.
ENT is that, you know, 15 years ago when we started developing these vaccines, we didn't know about head and neck cancers
sure.
caused by papillomaviruses. Now we do.
All the time.
And it turns out that many, a high percent, maybe 30-40% of head and neck cancers that are not associated with smoking and alcohol consumption are related to human papillomavirus.
I feel like we hammer this one all the time, but that's because I'm an ENT, so I have to. It's like
exactly.
plugging my own stuff.
Right.
We're crossing the threshold where more head and neck cancers are caused from HPV than are from smoking, and we have patients in clinic all the time who you ask them, have you ever smoked? And they say, no, not once in my life.
Exactly.
And they've got a big cancer sitting in the back of their throat. So
exactly.
preventable, theoretically, with this vaccine.
Correct. And we probably won't see a huge amount of prevention related to head and neck cancers for another 10, 12 years.
Sure.
But we know how effective this vaccine is at preventing the sexually transmitted infections related to HPV and the cancers there.
Now, I've got to give out our phone number again, 800-552-8502. We've got two physicians here. We've got Dr. Singh and Dr. Vancheri. Dr. Singh, we're about to get to your wheelhouse in just a second.
Sure.
We've actually got David from Minden on the line, so let me see if I can bring him over here. David, you are on the air.
Okay, thank you. My question is, are there vaccinations against hepatitis A, B, and C? And also, are these contagious diseases?
All right. Thank you, David. So there are vaccines currently available against hepatitis A and hepatitis B. And hepatitis C, we don't have a vaccine yet, but we have some very, very, very effective treatments that are really changing the dynamics there for hepatitis C. So A and B, all children now recommended to get hepatitis A and B vaccines in the United States and in Louisiana in particular.
Okay. David, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate your questions. Again, anyone that has questions out there, 800-552-8502. We are on with Dr. Vancheri and Dr. Singh. Now, this is – oh, excuse me.
Let
Dr.
me just
Vancheri,
follow
please.
Up. His last question is, are these infectious things? And the answer is yes, they are. They are transmitted from person to person. So that's what infectious means. They're transmitted in different ways. Hepatitis A is usually transmitted from contamination from feces of a person who has hepatitis A. Hepatitis B and C are transmitted by – can be transmitted by blood products or by sexual transmission. All of our blood products that were used in hospitals are screened for hepatitis B and C, HIV, and other viruses that could be transmitted that way.
Okay. Well, thank you again, David. We really do appreciate you calling in. All right, guys. So I like to play a little game with our guests. This has nothing to do with anything that you're good at, which is my favorite part of it. I don't know if you've ever listened to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. This is my little version of it. So that they have a segment called That's Not My Job, and that's what this is. So you are both experts in medicine and today experts in back to school. So today I have quiz questions for you about school supplies, which I assume you probably know a lot about because, you know, why wouldn't you? So here is a question that I have for you. Some of the answers are true. Some of them are made up. That's your job to determine. So number one in our hearts, the number two pencil is the standard for both standardized testing and for breaking off right in the middle of the exam when you are about to finish. And also for being used to flick into the ceiling and see if you can make them stick. So which of these outrageous pencil facts is correct and which did I just make up? Number one. A pencil can write a total of 45,000 words before kicking the bucket. The original, number two, the original lead-containing pencils were outlawed after President Woodrow Wilson became very ill after chewing on pencils. The original phrase, number three, the original phrase to get the lead out refers to taking pencils out of your bag for school and is not actually a reference to Led Zeppelin, as many people now think it is. Or number four, the cost of producing a single Apple pencil is roughly equal to the cost of producing 500 standard number two pencils, but the markup is just markedly higher on the electronic version. Dr. Singh, let's start with you.
I'm going to say Woodrow Wilson got sick.
Woodrow Wilson
got
sick.
All
right.
So we're looking for the...
The true answer,
the
yes.
True answer.
Three of these I have made up.
Well, I know the Led Zeppelin one you've made up.
a Led fan here, huh?
Yeah. And so the Woodrow Wilson is conceivable, although the cost of making number two pencils is probably pretty cheap compared to the stylus that we use.
Which could it be?
I don't know. I'm going to take number four.
You're going to take number four. The actual answer, a number two pencil can write 45,000 words before it kicks the bucket.
I thought it was more
so
than that.
Ambiguous. Yeah. It depends on the word.
Yeah, that's right. How long are your words?
I guess that's true. In this crowd, it's probably more like 10,000 words. But I think in an average crowd, like in a paper that I wrote, it would be 45,000. Maybe not in a paper that y'all wrote. The eraser, on the other hand, can only erase about 10 words before being completely used up. Now, I have more questions for you, but my goodness, we have people calling in. So we've got Betty from Apple Springs. Hold on. I'm going to try to get you on, Betty. I've got to figure out which line you're on. Here we are. All right, Betty, you are on with Dr. Vancheri and Dr. Singh.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I am a member of the station. I'd like to know if a 79-year-old, which I am, needs to be concerned if you are sexually active of HPV.
An excellent question.
Well, that is a great question, and I get this question not uncommonly. The At age 79, actually now above age 45, I believe, is the oldest that we have data on the efficacy and safety of this vaccine. So we're going to say everybody above age 45. We don't have data on really to justify that everyone above age 45 should get the vaccine. Now, what does that mean? That means that if we're going to consider using the vaccine above age 45, that would be considered an off-label use. That's not a use that's been studied by the company or approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And then what that means is, as physicians, we can consider on an individual patient basis whether to use a vaccine or a medication, prescription drug, or something that might be approved for something else. Physicians, by their pharmacy license, have the ability to use medications or vaccines in an off-label use. So would it be recommended for routine use in anyone over age 45? The answer is no. Might it be considered for use between a physician and an individual patient based on individual patient factors, risk factors? And the answer would be yes. And so what would those risk factors be? It might be risk factors like multiple sexual partners, or anticipation of future dating, perhaps someone who's recently divorced or who's recently lost a spouse and they're going to get back into the dating environment and looking for a future spouse. That might be a consideration, but those kind of discussions should happen between an individual physician and a patient about their individual risk factors.
Excellent. Sarah, Betty, thank you so much for calling. Good gracious. Let's try that again. Betty, thank you so much for calling. We actually have another caller on the air. We've got Sarah from Shreveport. Sarah, you are on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
So I was just calling about for a family who's expecting a baby, do the grandparents and the uncles need to become vaccinated or have boosters, and what's the timeline on that?
Excellent question. Yes, this is a very important area, and you may have seen some TV commercials in the past year about the grandmother who turns into a wolf and the recommendations that she get a vaccine. So the particular vaccine we're talking about is the vaccine called Tdap, which includes the pertussis component. Pertussis is a respiratory bacteria that can cause fatal infection in young infants. And so the current recommendation, number one, is that women who are pregnant should get a dose of a booster of Tdap to boost their pertussis immunity during pregnancy. And that's one of the very, very few vaccines that is recommended to be given during pregnancy, the other one being influenza. And then the second part of that strategy is, what about grandmas and uncles and other folks around, adults who may not have had a booster that included pertussis for a number of years? And the answer is yes, they should all. Anyone who's going to be around that infant should be vaccinated against pertussis.
All right. Sarah, thank you so much for calling in. We've had a couple callers already. So again, if you have any questions for Dr. Vancheri or Dr. Singh, 1-800-552-8502. No question is too outrageous. Now, technically, we are talking about back to school today, but that doesn't mean you can't just ask questions that are on your mind or on your heart that you've just had, a burning desire to ask. You've called your physician 10 times. They won't return your calls. Well, we are here. I know, they both just gave me the no, don't say that sign. But I don't have to answer the question, so I can say anything. It's great. Please call in. Give us your brain busters. All right, so let's move on a little bit. So we've talked a little bit about vaccinations, so obviously vaccinations are important. Let's talk about some lifestyle stuff. So we are getting back into school. Now, during summer, my favorite thing is staying up late and, waking up late. You don't have to worry about it. But let's talk about sleep a little bit, because I feel like sleep is a topic that parents and children battle with, and they fight, and it's like, who's right here? So, Dr. Singh, talk to me a little about sleep. How much is enough? How much are kids needing?
Well, to say there's one magical number for the entire population of everyone is, you know, not really reasonable. But the science that has come out about the importance of sleep for daily functioning and learning is irrefutable. And many teachers will tell you that they can tell when kids are sleep deprived in their class, that they have a lot more trouble focusing. And we can think about this in our own work life. I know that on days that I'm sleep deprived, and I'm sure you've experienced the same thing, that you just don't think as well. And this is definitely true for kids. So in general, you know, the younger they are, they probably need a little bit more. Grade school, elementary school, 9 to 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And teenagers can actually go one way or the other. Many teens do go through a time where they have increased sleep needs and their sleep actually shifts. And so many of you may remember your mom getting on to you when you were younger because you wanted to stay up late on school nights and had trouble going to sleep. And that can actually be part of natural teen development, is mm-hmm. sort of a shift in their sleep. But in general, 9 hours should really be the minimum that everyone is kind of shooting for.
Nine hours?
Well, in grade school and growing kids,
wow.
Yes.
Wow. So the whole, I do just fine with six, you know, is that, you don't buy that?
I don't buy it.
You do just fine with six until you don't.
Until you don't,
and then,
yeah.
You know, the thing is about sleep, you can never catch up for sleep you've missed.
That's true. Right. You can't make up for it.
And it is actually more than just focus. You may be able to second this. There's some good evidence that lack of sleep weakens our immune system, makes us more susceptible to infection. And so sort of the old adage of, oh, I got sick because I was so stressed out and sleep deprived, there's actually some science for that.
Wow. Is there any concept of or truth to the idea of developing better because you're sleeping? You know, you grow taller. You know, you always hear people say, get your sleep, you'll get taller. Don't drink caffeine. Is there any truth to any of that?
That's not standing out in my mind.
Not standing
I'm sure
out
if
mind.
We dug deep enough, we could find an article that said whatever you want it to say.
You're particularly tall. Did you sleep a lot? I mean, we can just use you as a case study.
Yeah, I don't think that that's not the most important. Gaining adequate height is not the first and foremost thing that should be on your mind when you're thinking about sleep.
Okay, so if you want to join the basketball team, don't worry about your sleep.
About getting better grades, having a calmer mind, and
okay, all right. So more lifelong goals. Now the problem is that they've done studies that teenagers have a difficult time understanding that they will one day be older. So the idea of these abstract concepts of doing good in school now so that I will succeed later is difficult for them. So really we need to give them concrete things like, but you'll be taller tomorrow. So I feel like that may be more helpful. So teens, if you're listening out there, if you sleep, you might get taller. That's not true. I'm sorry. I can't endorse that medically. So we did say that needs change over a lifetime. So explain to me this concept of like shifting sleep. So teenagers sleep later?
Well, they tend to have the desire to go to sleep later, and probably a lot of that is social and habits and simply behavioral. Mm-hmm. But there is some documentation that they really can't go to sleep. They don't feel sleepy until later, and then they have the desire to sleep later in the morning. And many teachers of first hour will tell you that for the first hour of school, they have a hard time with their students very first thing in the morning.
Sure.
And some of that's unavoidable. Some of that is just natural adolescent development. But there are some things you can do, and honestly, most of this is exactly what you've heard before, and the fact is that good sleep habits have pretty much been standard for years and years. It's not magic, and mm-hmm. they work remarkably well. Same bedtime every night, no digital for an hour, no screens for an hour before bedtime, and okay. I can hear the collective gasp right now, right, from everyone. But even for adults, those blue backlights on our phone, on our TV, those stimulate parts of your brain that you can't feel. So just because you don't feel like they keep you awake, you're not able to tell that they're stimulating wake centers in your brain. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown that electronics for an hour within bedtime does affect sleep.
Okay.
So that's one thing, not a very popular recommendation.
Sleep latency, but what does it affect about your sleep, I guess?
Ability to fall asleep is
okay.
the main thing.
So it's like a sleep latency concept.
Correct.
It takes you longer. You lie in bed mm-hmm. and you can't figure out why. Maybe
yes.
it's because you're staring at your phone.
Yeah, maybe so.
You also have to turn your phone off. So, I mean, an hour. So what about something like reading a book?
Reading a book, old school, is great. In fact, a boring book works beautifully for many people.
Okay, so
I laugh
I need to
at
get
my
the
house.
Medical books out.
Yes, exactly. Read some medical books or... I won't say any names. I don't want to insult any literary people, but I have one right now that is working like a charm. It puts me to sleep. It's a classic, and I'll just read that. But yes, old school is best. Paper books work great. Now, they don't stimulate the wake centers, is what
I mean.
Now,
here's a question. Kindle, the electronic book.
Mm-hmm.
What about that? I mean, is it lit? I mean, not really. It's a screen, technically, but none of the blue backlights.
Yes. So they, and truthfully, I don't know the exact outcome evidence on that. I know that there's been some discussion in the circles of the reader developers that mm-hmm. they say that they are mitigating that effect in their technology.
Mm-hmm.
Truthfully, I don't know the exact answer.
That's okay. I mean, that was kind of a shot in the dark. It was more my own curiosity. I have a Kindle sitting by my bed, and I wondered, am I screwing up my own sleep? I don't want that. So we've got sleep schedules, so it's mm-hmm. important to have the same, you know, time to bed, time when you wake up. And I feel like that's tricky for some parents with younger kids, especially. With older kids, it gets to be more routine. But with younger kids that don't want to go to bed at the same time, is there any way to mitigate that?
I think it's actually somewhat
the opposite.
The opposite?
I agree.
I have no children, so you have to tell me.
I have a few, some of whom are listening. So it's kind of the opposite. As they get into middle school mm-hmm. and high school, they have a lot more activities in the evening. And so the likelihood that they're going to go to sleep at a set bedtime is much more difficult to pin down, especially if they have a homework assignment that's due the next day that they've been putting off for 2 weeks or so,
sure.
you know, that catches up to them. So with the younger children, it's, I think, you know, early school grades, elementary grades, it's much easier because they're not having late mm-hmm. evening or late afternoon activities as much.
Now, I guess that also leads into another question. You've also heard the whole wind down hour. You know, you spend an hour, you don't immediately exercise right before bed. You don't do any like strenuous activities right before bed.
I thought that meant you don't wind for an hour before bed.
You don't wind for an hour? I choose to. I don't want to go to work tomorrow. I don't want to just...
Yeah.
Dr. Nathan, if you're listening, I never say that. I always want to go to work. So is there any truth to that, like the idea of taking some time to just kind of be calm, relax for an hour? Or, I mean...
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And in truth, being a parent of teenagers myself, I don't know how practical that is, at least daily during school, when there's activities until 7:30 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
They come home trying to get some food into them, and then the homework begins. So, yes, in an ideal world, it would be great if everybody were sitting around relaxing for an hour with a book and a cup of herb tea before bedtime. But mm-hmm. I think that most parents of teenagers don't really find that
I'm pretty
it's
sure
happening.
That's a scene from Pride and Prejudice. Again, if you want to call in and talk to Dr. Van Cherry or Dr. Singh, our number is 1-800-552-8502. Answering your questions about back to school, sleep, peacefulness, blue lights on your phone, and vaccination. So anything you want to ask about those things, we have answers for. Now, Dr. Singh, what about naps? Is there an effective way to nap? Is there a good way to nap? Because, you know, some people, they'll tell you, oh, I nap for 5 minutes and I feel great. And some people are like, when I nap, I only nap for 4 hours at a time. I mean, talk to me about naps a little bit. I don't understand naps.
What demographic are you meaning? You mean little kid naps?
You mean
grown-up naps?
Well, we're talking back to school. So let's start with little kids and then let's move into teenagers and young adults. We won't talk about grown-up naps because this is back to school. So we're going to say, you know, adults, you got to figure out napping on your own right now. But what about kids?
Well, I think naps are pretty personal also. And I think most parents will tell you that they had fantasies of their child napping on a set schedule and up until a certain age until the parent decided. And then we have children and we realize that you know, you don't get to pick.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that most children will benefit from a nap during the first 4 to 5 years of life. And then they generally start to fall off on their nap requirements. And that shows up just as their complete inability to fall asleep in the afternoon during nap time. We all remember that one kid who laid awake all during nap time, right, and could not go to sleep. And so that's always going to be there. As people get older, whether or not they nap is completely individualized.
Sure.
Many people will tell you that if they have a nap, their sleep is destroyed for that evening. And many people will tell you that they have to have a 20 to 45 minute nap every afternoon
mm-hmm.
Or they can't function. So I think that's really individualized.
Is there anything to be said for using naps to catch up for missed sleep? Or, I mean, we already talked about it earlier, you can't do much to catch up. So if you had a bad night last night, is there anything to be said for like, oh, well, if you can catch a nap in the morning or early afternoon, then you'll be good to go and you'll make up for all that you lost?
I think coming from a history, as the two of you also have, of episodes in our life where we were severely sleep deprived, I think that's just really individualized. Just some people will say that they do better with a nap, you know, the next day, if it's even possible. With many people's jobs, they can't catch a makeup nap. So I think that's just individualized.
Yeah, it's like a booster. You know, it won't catch up for everything or make up for everything, but just a little boost in the middle of the day to, sure. know, it's like having a second cup of coffee right after lunch. Just
right.
Kind of
right.
give you a little surge.
I know that we've talked about this. I mean, in residency, sleepiness on the job is a big deal, thus the 80-hour resident work week, thus all these, you know, different rules. And we talk about sleep inertia sometimes. So the idea of a nap being too long or in that gray zone between just short enough to be a boost and too not long enough to be an actual sleep. So anything in that range that you've got guidance on?
I think the 20 to 30 minute nap is sort of the ideal in
sure.
that, because you don't want to get all the way to deep sleep,
right?
And so it's just a little call it a cat nap, a
yeah.
power nap, some people call it.
I think right. that's what they say. I think it's, what is it? It's like 20 to 30 minutes is a power nap, but if you do it longer than 20 minutes, it almost needs to be like a two-hour nap, because you have to go through a full REM cycle
right.
before you wake back up. Otherwise, you'll wake up feeling groggy. So I know that in residency, at least, they always encourage us either 20 to 30 minutes or at least 2 hours. If you don't have one of those, then you're going to be in kind of that.
So that will be a good show for you to do with the sleep medicine folks from
oh, yeah.
medical school.
Right. Oh, are we writing that down?
The sleep medicine guys were on a couple of weeks ago, maybe.
Oh, my gosh. See, yeah. I need to listen to the show more. Again, if you have any questions for us, 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Vancheri and Dr. Singh. So we've kind of got sleep. I got one last question, I guess. So your kid's falling asleep in school a lot. I mean, what are some things that you would consider? What are some things that could be, you know, Jimmy keeps coming home, teacher keeps sending notes, he's falling asleep, it's third period. It's not just first period where, you know, everyone's naturally tired because their sleep cycle or sleep-wake cycle. It's third period, it's fourth period. Every day he's tired. What to be done about this?
I think the first thing would just be a good look at how much he's sleeping. The most common problem that would be causing that would be simple lack of sleep at night, just not getting enough hours of sleep. And the truth is that once kids get to be a little bit older and are sort of going into their room on their own to go to bed at night, I mean, I can say as a parent, I don't know exactly how many hours of sleep a night my child is getting. So it would probably require a little monitoring from mm-hmm. a mom or dad or whoever's caretaking to kind of see, okay, is he going in his room and staying awake until 3 a.m.? What's in there? Is the computer in there? Is the device in there? Let's see if we can get a handle on exactly how many hours of sleep the child is getting.
Okay.
That would be the primary cause. And I would estimate that the majority of the time that manipulating hours of sleep at night, setting up a good, boring sleep routine mm-hmm. in the evening, getting the devices and distractors out of the room
sure.
Would probably solve the majority of those problems.
Okay. So kids falling asleep in school.
And then I would say one thing to look at is nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Look at what are they eating for breakfast. And, you know, classically we talk about breakfast as the most important meal, and there are a lot of reasons for that. And I think that, you know, kids who have a lot of sugary things for breakfast are going to get a burst of energy through first and second period, but then they may crash in third and fourth period, you know. So things like, you know, bacon and eggs, not very practical every morning when you're rushing to get to school with multiple kids, but it's having a little protein in your diet early in the morning, I think, is also very helpful.
One other good study, too. This is one of the cheapest and easiest hacks around, is the fact that in some studies, they found that most children actually wake up mildly dehydrated every morning. And a simple intervention of asking a child to have a glass of water every morning, in addition to whatever they were normally having with breakfast, like juice or milk or whatever, actually improved their scores on cognitive and logic tests after hydration.
Wow.
So that's a cheap and easy. Now, as far as sleepiness, I don't think that it's been shown to affect that. But a glass of water in the morning for kids, and certainly also a harmless intervention for grown-ups too.
Right.
Start off the day hydrated. Our brain has to have plenty of hydration to function properly.
Mm.
So glass of water, first thing in the morning.
Yeah, my brain is mostly full of coffee at this point, so I need to take that to heart.
I think there's also some data on, you know, mild dehydration is associated with headaches too. And so people who are prone to having headaches, start with a glass of water. And especially if children are talking about having headaches, again, start with a glass of water. Let's get hydrated appropriately before we start to move on to more medical interventions.
Awesome. Now, we're going to actually, that you've segued perfectly for me. We're going to talk about nutrition in a second, but since I wrote these questions, I want to ask them to you. So we're going to switch back to our That's Not My Job segment, where I ask you questions that you have no reasonable shot at getting correct, which is fun for me. I confess I'm a little crestfallen whenever someone gets these answers right, because it means I did a bad job writing them. So we're going to move on to number two.
Wait, are you Googling?
No, I'm getting ready. I'm going to phone a friend.
You're going to phone a friend? Oh, gosh. Here we go. So crayons.
So
we've talked about pencils. So crayons, essentially a status symbol in kindergarten. So if you were lucky enough to have parents who could spring for the big pack of crayons, you know, the one with the sharpener in the back? I was never that kid, unfortunately. Then you were probably the coolest kid in kindergarten. So which of these colorful pieces of crayon trivia is true? Number one, there are 1,241 individually produced colors made by Crayola, but they are only available in specific countries many times, which is why we don't see them all here. Number two, Crayola crayons were invented by a candle maker in the early 1900s who had too much leftover wax and was looking for a way to entertain his bored children. Number three, the official name by Crayola for a remnant of a crayon is a Leftola, the Crayola Leftola. And then Rose Art, a chief competitor of Crayola, the wax writing implements they made used to be called Waxolas. However, a lawsuit in 1980s forced them to change their name. So now they're just Rose Art. What do we have? Dr. Vancieri, you actually went second last time. You've put your phone down.
I think there are 1,241 colors.
You have an unbelievable memory. 1,241. All right.
1,241.
That is correct. That was the number I quoted. I'm not going to say if that's the right answer, but that is the number I quoted.
You almost said it.
I know. I like the Waxola answer.
The Waxola answer.
Yes.
Oh, good. My streak continues. So the actual name for a leftover crayon is a Leftola.
Oh, stop.
That is endorsed by Crayola themselves. They actually requested that all children across the United States send in their blue Leftolas, and they melted them all down and made the world's largest crayon out of it. So it was about 15,000 Leftolas, and they melted them down and made the world's largest crayon. It is blue.
So my grade school children, I have an elementary school child and a middle school child, have taken all their leftover crayons and melting them down in little silicone cupcake molds in the oven at a very low level, and to make a big multicolor crayon.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's one of their hacks these days.
That could have been the Crayola creator in the 1900s with his bored children, but that was not correct. Interesting fact, they only make 120 colors. There are only 120 Crayola colors. They just rename them various things for different celebrities or different things that are happening. There's like Cyber Blue. Well, that's the same blue that they marketed, you know, 3 months ago as Ocean Blue, but now it's Cyber Blue. So, fun fact, 120 colors. All right, so, okay, fine. We've got you here. We've got to ask real serious questions. 1-800-552-8502 if you want to talk to Dr. Singh or Dr. Vancieri. We are, again, talking about back-to-school and back-to-school things. You have segued into nutrition for me. That was a great...
I did?
Somebody did.
Okay.
Somebody said nutrition, and I was like, that's like my next heading.
Oh, yeah,
so,
you did. You said breakfast.
You said breakfast, and I kind of want to go into that a little bit further. So what does a healthy diet for kids look like? I mean, do we have any idea in modern society what a healthy diet even looks like?
We have a lot to go on, although it is difficult, and the ideas about it are so murky, largely because of the media and because of how much confusing information comes out constantly in the media. And this can be confusing even for us as doctors,
sure,
because the scientific studies that we read, you know, there appears sometimes to be really conflicting information. But over the years and the decades that nutritional science has even been going on or even been studied, there are definitely some huge patterns that have emerged that thankfully have kind of become irrefutable. You know, the vast majority of us, no matter what diet church we belong to, can agree that the science shows that the more plant matter that is in your diet, your mom was right, we need vegetables. And the more fruits and vegetables that are in your diet, the better health outcomes are. And that's pretty straightforward, no matter what dietary approach is being discussed. So that's not always easy with kids. So I try to, you know, just help parents to remember, just, and even actually med students, residents, my family, anyone who will listen, just try to maximize the plant matter in your diet daily. And so one way to think about that is, with every meal, I need a fruit or a vegetable with every meal. So whether, you know, and they don't have to be exotic fruits or vegetables. Apples count. Of course, the most popular fruit in America is bananas. And
is that true?
Yeah.
Wow.
That apples count?
No, that bananas are the most popular fruit in America. Mm-hmm. I would have voted for an apple. I mean, you need apple pie, Johnny Appleseed. Anyway, banana. Interesting.
Right. So it doesn't have to be exotic fruit. Although varied colors do add a lot of nutritional benefit. So another easy thing to
explain
help.
Explain that.
Well,
your body recognizes blue versus red?
No, actually the reason that certain fruits and vegetables are certain colors is because of the chemicals that are contained in them.
Hmm.
So for instance, you know, grapes are grapey because of certain plant chemicals that are only in grapes, that are not found in apples, that are not found in oranges. They have their own profile of chemicals, some of those which are the chemicals that contribute color. So if you eat fruits and vegetables from a wide variety of colors, you're widening the number and types of awesome beneficial plant chemicals that go into your body, and they have different jobs, and some of them are vitamins, some of them are, you know, popular term antioxidants.
That's a buzzword.
Yes. And, you know, many of them have achieved sort of celebrity chemical status. You've heard of beta carotene and vitamin C and maybe lycopene. So these are all just chemicals that are only found in plants. Eating a wide variety of colors is good. You want to add to that?
No. Now, I guess this is good. So we've jumped on the we're pro veggie here. And pro fruit and veggies. So that's good because fruit's sweet. I feel like you can catch more kids with fruit. And we like colors, partially because it's, you know, interesting and children are ADD. So it like brings them back in. Like, look at all the colors. But also because of the different chemicals. Now, what about the, so there's plenty of vegetarians out there who are like, I told you, this is what I've always said. But is there anything to be said for, you know, you had mentioned earlier a concept of protein in your diet. Like, I mean, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. Let me just start with this. I like protein. I'm not a protein hater or anything like that. But I do think that the media has achieved what is honestly an advertising coup in that they've convinced us as a population that we are essentially a protein deficient society. And that whether we want to lose weight, gain weight, or stay the same weight, we need their product. We need it, and we can't get it from just normal food that you would buy in the grocery store. We need to really focus on it. The fact is that there is no scientific evidence that we as a population have a significant protein deficiency. And there's also really no science that increasing the protein in your diet. Now, I know that there are definitely some studies that show that eating a higher pro low carb diet can cause weight loss. That's definitely there. I'm already eating enough calories, but I need to supplement my protein by getting more protein in. There's really no studies that show that that helps some of our major health problems in the United States, which are blocked coronary arteries, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. What we do know, though, is that as a country, we don't get enough fiber. And there's definitely studies that show that the vast majority of Americans, only one out of 20 Americans, meets even the minimum requirements for fiber. And there are a lot of good studies that show an association between eating a diet that's rich in fiber and lower rates of disease.
Interesting.
So one thing I like to tell parents is, as long as your kid is, and even adults, as long as you're getting enough calories every day in America, it's actually kind of hard to really be protein deficient. But if you can focus on fiber, then you can actually start changing some of your disease risk in the long run.
Right. And fiber is those fruits and vegetables we talked about.
I mean,
those are primarily fiber, and I want to make sure people understand that.
So it's easy to get
not
your fiber.
I don't mean in a jar of fiber. Yeah. I don't mean a supplement.
So we're not encouraging the elementary schoolers out there to have Metamucil every day?
Although constipation is such a significant problem in pediatrics, I'm sure many of them are on Metamucil every day. But
that's why everyone's so grumpy in America. We're fiber deficient and we're constipated. So if we would just all get a little more regular, we'd get along a lot better. Now, we could be on to something there. That can be another day. We'll come back to that topic. Now, I've actually got Candy from Fort Worth here who's calling in. Candy, you are on the air.
Oh, hi. This is actually a nutrition question. I have a daughter going into first grade, and we are starting to pack her lunch, and they are not allowed to bring any of those Little Debbie cakes in, but she doesn't eat anything. So I was wondering if you had some suggestions for sweet alternatives that I can bring that I will not get in trouble with the school board. And does it really matter if she has Little Debbie cakes?
Well, so you're specifically asking mainly about sweets, something like a treat type thing?
Well, yes, because she doesn't eat too much, so sweets is her favorite.
Of course.
But we're specifically forbidden from bringing any kind of Little Debbie cakes.
I understand.
They will be taken from their lunch.
Wait, specifically like Little Debbie branded?
Or just any kind of processed sweet foods.
Processed foods will be taken from her.
I was going to say, that's suspect otherwise.
No, actually, my child attends a school that has the same rule. So if you're worried just about calories in your child, I would really advise you to talk to your pediatrician and maybe get a consultation with a dietitian, if she's actually just not growing properly. But the concern that my child is not eating enough is extremely common. I worried about it in my kids. Almost everyone has worried about it then. The good news is that if your child is reasonably healthy at baseline, if they are in an environment where food is available, they're probably going to get enough calories simply because the hunger drive in humans is such that it's very difficult for a child that age to just sort of voluntarily starve themselves. As long as they're in an environment where food is available, they're going to be driven to request food or to ask for food. But I understand that as a parent, you want to provide them with something that you enjoy. They should enjoy eating also, right? We get a lot of pleasure out of food. For sweets, always, of course, fruit. And I know that probably the next thing you may say to me is that, but she doesn't like fruit. And one thing that actually helps kids not enjoy fruit is a diet that has plenty of processed sweets in it. Because, as you can imagine, if you were to eat a Little Debbie and then immediately after that have a bite of apple, the apple probably wouldn't taste as exciting, right, as the Little Debbie. So what happens over time is that we get used to a certain amount of wow on our taste buds that really just comes from processed sweets and processed fats. And after a steady diet of those wow foods, then our normal programming, which is to kind of look at an apple and say, wow, we don't think wow about an apple anymore because we want the Little Debbie. So although the first few days can be rough, a diet that is lower in those processed sugars will actually allow the taste buds, and this has been shown in science, the taste buds will actually change and fruit begins to taste good to people. Now, in the meantime.
Just after a few days?
Yes, believe it or not, in just a few days.
Amazing.
Right.
Okay,
it is amazing. But some natural things that might help her satisfy her sweet and provide some healthy calories. Nothing is sweeter than a date. You can buy pitted dates in any grocery store.
I thought that was a Hallmark card. I'm sorry.
It does sound like a Hallmark
Nothing
card.
Nothing is sweeter than a date. Sorry, continue.
So, some of the sweeter fruits, so you might try to help her get involved, pick out some fruits at the store. Mangoes that are ripened in season are extremely sweet. Honestly, depending on the season, peaches and berries can be dicey. Sometimes they're sour. But those things are good. I don't know how she feels about raisins. That's another slightly sweet thing. The other thing is on your Little Debbies, I haven't read the label recently on a Little Debbie, but I do know that most of the fat that is found in some of the yummy or processed sweets is actually saturated fat or trans fat even. Some of those ingredients can contain trans fats, which we really, really want to minimize in our diet.
Well, Candy, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate your contribution to the show. Again, if you have any questions, we're kind of running towards the end of our show. 1-800-552-8502, 1-800-552-8502. So, Candy, we appreciate it. Good luck with the lack of Little Debbies out there. I really did think at first that maybe this was like someone from Hostess ran the school and they were like, you can't have Little Debbies here, but you can bring, I don't know, maybe Little Debbie's owned by Hostess, but either way, Twinkies are allowed, but Ding Dongs, no go. So I guess that leads to another interesting question that maybe we could talk about a little bit. So what about school lunches? So she said she's packing the lunch. I mean, do you find that most kids that are coming in that are being served by a cafeteria, are they getting these adequate, vegetable sources, green sources, plant-based sources? Are they getting a good diet, or is it important for parents to like supplement that and send them with like, here's an apple, make sure you eat it with your lunch? I mean, what have you found?
Well, I mean, the schools are providing a lunch that is meeting certain guidelines. So, there are federal and state guidelines that determine the number of calories, the number of fruits and vegetables that get served in school lunches. I think probably the bigger problem is what are kids choosing to eat when they're at school. So if you are able and you know for a fact that your child is, maybe you consider them picky or they've told you flat out they're not going to eat what's at school, then it might be worth it to try to pack a lunch. And I understand that that's just not feasible for everyone to pack a lunch for their child if their child has lunch at school.
Sure.
So I, of course, now you're talking to the My kids are at home rolling their eyes right now. Yes, they're going to have additional fruit with whatever they're consuming outside of the house, because that's just how we roll. But you're never going to look back and go, I probably shouldn't have sent that apple. You know, you're probably not going to think that. You can err a little bit on the side of a little more plant matter. But
I can't eat apples and peaches and pears and that ilk of fruit because I have a oral allergy to it.
Oh,
and so, believe me, I'd love to be able to bite into a few apples.
You know, it's something you don't know that you don't know what you got till it's gone.
That's
I guess.
Right. That's right.
Well, so the school, you're right. And the schools do have certain degrees of standards that they have to conform to.
Absolutely.
I guess. And I know that that's changed a lot, but I remember specifically in my own elementary school experience having a lot of pizza and chocolate milk. So I don't know what the standards are now, but I know that that's the case. So a healthy, well-rounded diet. I mean, what about like the 2000 calorie limit? I mean, is that like a real thing? Does that actually apply? You see that on the labels based on a 2000 calorie diet. Does that apply to kids?
Not to every child, no. Calorie requirements in kids are largely weight-based, and since kids grow constantly, their calorie requirement changes all the time. I don't think most of us in clinical medicine calculate kids' calorie needs much, as long as what we look at is if they're growing.
Mm-hmm.
And not overgrowing. I mean, that's the biggest thing that we're trying to emphasize now in pediatrics is that maintaining a healthy diet is important to maintaining a healthy weight. Because once you're off the scale on the weight side, once you're overgrown, it's much harder to get back to your normal pattern or where you should be. Very difficult.
So true.
Sure. So I guess that comes to another question we were talking, or just a question people have. It's like, what does exercise look like for kids? Because, you know, we talk about the diet side of things, and the diet side of things is obviously very important. If your child is overweight or if you're concerned about, you know, a child's weight, the diet is very important. But what about just like activity? In the modern world, we have video games, we have computers, we've got phones, we've got tablets. I mean, there's 1,000 things that you sit and you just, that's all you do. You sit with it. You don't play, you don't go outside and throw a ball. You can, you know, stay inside and throw a ball. What do you recommend for something like that? Like, is there any guideline on like how much should kids be doing? I know the NFL had a Play 60 campaign concept of playing an hour a day. I mean, do you find that that's pretty adequate for most people?
Well, that's the guideline, hour a day.
That's definitely the recommendation. And again, that also varies with age, but also varies with intensity of how strenuous what you're doing is. You know, for adults, 20 to 30 minutes a day of brisk walking is great and probably adequate to maintain. If you want to lose weight, you got to spend a few more calories, and it's that balance of calories in and calories out.
Sure.
And so for kids, activity should, you know, every child should participate in PE at school and have recess time. We know that kids who are physically active learn better, and so that physical activity stimulates the parts of the brain that help them learn better afterward. So I'm a big fan of activity at school, physical activity.
That's awesome. Now, I have one question that I want to get to. We're closing out the hour, but I think this is sort of important. So we talked a little bit about hydration. So we're in the hottest part of the year. This is when football camps are starting up. This is when band camps are starting up. And every year, I know at least in Texas, where I came from, there were always a couple reports across the state of a kid that would die in football practice from dehydration. They were out in the sun. It was hot. So I want to talk a little bit about hydration, because that's, I think, it starts with school because it's usually school-related activities, and it's this time of year. So talk to me about hydration. What's necessary for hydration? How much should kids be drinking? Like, let's get a little guideline here just quickly.
So water is number one. You know, we use lots of – we have available lots of sport drinks with salts and sugars in them. And there, I think the data is mixed on whether those are any better than water itself. I think maintaining hydration is primarily a water issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I know myself, working 2 or 3 hours in the yard, I can be, you know, dehydrated by several liters per hour or liter or more per hour in the heat. So keeping up with that is important. And one of the easiest ways to measure that is actually urine output.
Mm-hmm.
If you're making urine, that means you're hydrated enough.
Sure.
And we'll let your kidneys and especially handle the electrolyte balances you need. Now, if you're drinking sport drinks, it is important that those have a little bit of sugar in them, because we know that salt uptake is related, it requires sugar co-uptake. And so the physiology is that you need a little sugar to get the salt in if you're going to use sports drinks.
Mm-hmm. And just one more thing to add to that too, if they wait to start drinking until practice begins, then they're probably going to get behind a lot quicker. They should actually start hydrating a few hours before practice, an hour or two before practice.
Wow. Well, Dr. Singh, Dr. Vancheri, we are out of time. I really appreciate y'all being on tonight. I know this is something we actually had a lot of callers. I think that this is something we could talk about many more times. But again, thank you so much for being on with us tonight to talk about back to school and children's health. So Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, its staff, or LSUS. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Sheila Edwards, and Tim Snell. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation, also from the Community Foundations of North Louisiana. Please join us next week for Health Matters, where we will be discussing sports medicine. So I'm Dr. Patrick Labo. We've had Dr. Vancheri and Dr. Singh on tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.